Washington, D.C., 2 a.m. Emergency room call placed to Dr. Robert Keating, Chief of Neurosurgery at Children's Hospital.
Well, it's been a rough week on call, rougher than usual. Then again, that's what we're paid to do. And I remember I got a phone call sometime after midnight about a 14-year-old that had been shot in the head. And believe it or not, was still moving his extremities.
We have a gunshot wound to the head. So imagine you're a neurosurgeon on call. It's 2 a.m., and that's the emergency room doctor on the line. That is a very lonely call. Many conditions in neurosurgery these days can be managed by competing specialists with the right fellowship training. Neurologists and interventional radiologists can treat cerebral aneurysms. Orthopedists can perform spinal surgery. Radiation oncologists can target brain tumors. But when it comes to a gunshot wound to the head, there is no one clamoring for that case. No one at your back. And as a neurosurgeon, you will always be called. Our neurosurgeon in Washington, D.C., Dr. Bob Keating, will now tell us about one such case. And like many of these stories, even those where the outcome seems preordained, there's a twist.
He was still pouring blood out of his head into the surrounding bandages and bed sheets. There was an immediate need to get things moving if we had any chance of saving this patient. And so I told my resident, if he's alive and he's moving everything, we need to try to do something to maintain his life. I told my resident, I'll meet you in the OR, get him downstairs, make sure there's lots of blood prepared, and we'll do the best that we can. Well, the prognosis didn't sound good. He had received at that point up to 10 units of blood, and by report was hemorrhaging extensively despite pressure and packaging placed around his exit site on the head. But nevertheless, his pupils are still working, and surprisingly, he was still moving everything. So as I drove into the hospital quickly, fortunately only a 12-minute drive away, I was now wondering, what do we do about the bleeding? Is this involving one of the sinuses, which received 20% of the patient's blood at any point in time, and that can be very challenging to deal with. It's hard now trying to stop uncontrolled bleeding in a gunshot wound. And then I get to the operating room, and as usual, the dedicated and professional teams were in the process of getting him ready. They were putting in tubes and lines, trying to just keep up with his massive blood loss. And as we brought him in, I looked at my res and I said, this guy's not 14. He looks closer to 25. And the resident said, yeah, we all thought the same, but somebody at the scene said he was 14. And that's why they brought him here rather than to the city hospital next door. I went out to talk to the family. At this point, the anesthesiologists were trying with tremendous effort to just get his blood pressure to a point where he would tolerate putting him to sleep and then removing or opening up the gunshot exit wound and trying to do whatever we could to stem the bleeding. So I had a few minutes, and I wanted to at least let the family know what was going on, and perhaps more importantly, that the prognosis was poor at best. And then when I went into just myself, there were a number of family members in the room, his mother, a number of sisters and his aunts, and obviously quite concerned and upset. And I remember the mother looking at me saying, please do what you can to save him. We were here 3 years ago when he was shot 14 times, and they did a great job here in saving him. And I looked at the mother in somewhat disbelief. I said, 14 times? She said, yes, he was involved with a gang war, and he got shot 14 times, and they were able to save him when they brought him here to Children's Hospital. And I looked at Mom. I said, is he really 14? He looks a lot older. She says, oh, no, he's 20. But we thought this is the best place, and that's why we told him he was 14. Any other place, he would have died. And I understood as a parent what Mom was saying, and I couldn't blame her for that. And I said to her, I said, well, look, I said, I don't know what's going to happen. He's bleeding uncontrollably right now, and we're trying to get just enough blood into him so we can get ahead of the curve. But I said, in all honesty, I'll do everything I can, but I may not be able to save him.
The practice of medicine begins with the care for another person, a passion for science and research, and a fascination with the beauty and mystery of the natural world. On this podcast, we will hear from the medical professionals themselves, sharing their struggles and successes, bringing us into the ORs, ERs, and ICUs across the nation. Welcome to the real stories of a life in medicine. Welcome to the Life Medical. Welcome back to the Life Medical Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Peter Zahos, and I'm so excited to share this episode with you. We're going to be focusing on the stories of two of our nurse correspondents who have been on the front lines of the COVID pandemic since its start in the New York area. Traditionally, it's been celebrated as National Nurses Week, which ends on May 12th, Florence Nightingale's birthday. Florence Nightingale is credited as one of the founders of modern nursing. She's the proverbial Lady of the Lamp, making her rounds on the battlefields of the Crimean War over 160 years ago. Sadly, the battlefield analogy is apt, given the strains and stresses of the pandemic across the medical profession over the last year and a half. In fact, the theme of the first week of this now expanded nursing month is devoted to self-care, and we at the Life Medical Podcast couldn't agree more regarding the need for attention to the nurse's well-being, both mentally and physically. We're going to talk to two nurses at different stages of their careers. Amy Patchuk is a nurse at Stony Brook University Hospital. She's been working for over 15 years in the ICU. She's an educator and a union rep. Bailey Suh is about 7 years into her career as an ICU nurse. She came from Baltimore to serve in the pandemic and hasn't left since her arrival over a year ago. Let's listen to their stories now.
Amy Patchuk, ICU nurse and teaching nurse at Stony Brook University Hospital, Long Island, New York.
Things were different after the first wave. In the late spring and early summer, what we had noticed was that most people who were coming to the hospital were coming for whatever reason that they needed to come to the hospital. They weren't really necessarily coming with COVID symptoms. We were detecting COVID in people. It was generally happenstance. So from September to December, things were incredibly different. No longer were we getting the happenstance patients. These people were coming into our place of work, this hospital, this intensive care unit, as people who couldn't breathe. It was incredibly similar to before, and we didn't have as many people as we had in the late winter, early spring, but the patients that we did have were really sick. Most of the staff couldn't believe that they had to relive the trauma yet again. I think we thought that we would never have to deal with it again. But then in the last months here of 2020, what we realized is that COVID is going to be with us for the rest of our careers and the rest of our lives. In this last wave, in the end of like the last wave here, because I feel like the last, we had as many as 300 inpatients. So that means that the door evolves a little bit. People leave, some people die, some people go to rehab, more people come in. So it was sort of relentless for multiple months, November, December, January, and part of February. And in February, we start to see the numbers trickle down a little bit. With that being said, we also saw the numbers of our staff trickle down. You're working short all the time and not with the appropriate equipment and not with the appropriate tools that you normally have, that I realized that I was like, where am I? What am I doing? And I'm just functioning as a critical care person who's really experienced. And I'm literally, I can't remember stuff. I'm like, oh my God, I need to get some help for myself. From January to now, we have dealt with chronic patients, chronic COVID patients, patients who we know will die. It's just a matter of when. I work with expert nurses. My staff that I work with are really stunning, well-educated, great performers. Our patients normally have outstanding outcomes. People who would normally pass or expire make it.
Amy, since last we spoke, you've been terrific on recording some of your experiences over the last few months, you know, late fall into winter and now into spring. One of the points that I thought was really important to emphasize that you brought up was the idea that the media seems to have moved on in many cases in terms of the coverage of what is going on in hospitals, the coverage of the toll it's taking on healthcare workers. As we've discussed, they're talking about, you know, the vaccine rollout and all things that are also newsworthy. But do you notice also that it seems in some ways the media has moved on regarding the stories of people on the front lines?
I think totally, actually. The things that you hear are sort of like reflective. So frankly, it's like crickets now from like the nursing or doctor perspective. The media shift has really been from talking about the experience and seeing the patients to let's get everybody vaccinated. Let's get everybody vaccinated, which is, I agree with that. Let's get everybody vaccinated. But the truth is that if you look at a multitude of places, we're still in it. We're still short-staffed. We still have a significant amount of COVID patients. We still have anywhere from 70 to 90 patients a day. It's oscillating. And these are in makeshift units. So no one's really talking about it. And these people are as sick as they were.
They used to lead with these stories all the time. It would be like one after another, an ER in Arizona, something else going on in Texas, something else, you know, et cetera. Even though there are less patients, they're just as sick. And often they're younger patients, as you've highlighted. Is that the case?
The young folks. By young, I mean anywhere from like 20 to let's say 65 were out and about. And they thought that they were okay because they were sitting at a table at, let's say, a wedding. Oh, I'm sitting down eating, or I went to a birthday party. I'm sitting down eating. These are my family. They're okay. I'm not going to get anything. I'll be fine. And then they got it.
Amy brings up an important point. According to CDC data, over the last 4 months, the demographics of hospitalized patients has seen a major shift. Americans 65 years and older make up 28% of hospitalizations, which is a 25% drop from early January of this year. However, patients between the ages of 18 and 49 now account for 36% of hospitalizations, a nearly 16-point increase. The chief medical officer of the largest healthcare provider in Maine was quoted in the Wall Street Journal as saying that the average age of hospitalizations has gone way down and that the only patients they're seeing in the ICU are those who are not vaccinated.
And then they would go see their loved ones and they had the same mentality when they were at their own homes or visiting them at their house. So initially we saw older folks, super old, and now the people who are like really sick are really upper 30s, probably to maybe 63. That's a You're young. I'm sorry. You're really young if you're going to die at that age, unless you have, you know, your heart stopped working and we had to code you and you're in heart failure. But the truth is that these people, after they've been intubated, let's say over 2 or 3 weeks, it's really unlikely that they're going to live. So sometimes these people are on vents for like, there's a woman that I was taking care of. It was her 3-month anniversary on a ventilator with the same ET tube because her settings are too high on the vent. So she actually can't be trached. They can't bring her to the OR safely and transition her to a trach. This woman.
So she, if I may say, so that means she's had an ET tube.
The same ET tube.
The same for that period of time, which means what is going on in terms of strictures and all that. I mean, it throws out our core concepts of how you treat ICU patients. An ET tube or endotracheal tube is a flexible plastic tube that is placed through the mouth into the windpipe of a patient to protect their airway and to allow connection to a ventilator, which then delivers oxygen to their lungs. These tubes are designed to stay in generally no more than 2 weeks. The longer an ET tube is placed in a patient, the greater the risk of additional infections, of tightness around the trachea, which can lead to scarring. All these issues can make it more difficult to get a patient off ventilator support, which is a serious matter. A tracheostomy is a surgical incision through the front of the neck into the windpipe. The resulting hole or stoma can be used to place a tube or cannula into the trachea, which allows the airway to be protected and kept open. Early on, it can be connected to a ventilator, later to a source of external oxygen, and ultimately, when a patient is decannulated, the stoma itself can be used as an airway. Decannulation is just a fancy way of saying that the tube is removed from the windpipe.
If we expect you to be vented or vent dependent for a period of time, like longer than 2 weeks, we would trach you. That's the process. Because what happens is all of the structures that are close to where that tube needs to be so that you can be connected to the ventilator, they break down and they erode internally. So a normal time for someone to be trached when we realize that they're going to be a chronic vent patient is anywhere from like the 10 to 14 day mark. So now her anniversary, I call it her anniversary because like I always get her. She's like so sick. Like she's like my permanent patient assignment. Well, now it's actually 3.5 months she's been intubated. So God bless her. She's been hypoxic. She probably has had like anoxic brain injury because she's been so hypoxic. But her heart was relatively healthy and her kidneys are relatively healthy. So because her heart is healthy and her kidneys are healthy, her body's just going to live because we're providing her with the oxygen support she needs. Every once in a while, she'll need to go like on pressors and stuff. She has like a downturn. I call her a cat, God bless her. This woman has like 9 lives. Like she I think she's on live 7. We counted like the amount of times that she's going up and down. So we're like, how much longer will it be?
So is that an example? You talk about the chronic COVID patient. Is that, I mean, that's a pretty extreme example, but these are patients who are living, is chronic COVID in your, you know, concept, those that are living with the disease for a longer period of time, as opposed to the long haulers or the these other things that are also kind of termed chronic.
Yeah. So for example, there was a patient that I had had the first wave. He was a fairly young guy. He literally had nothing wrong with him. He was like I think he was like 27 years old, essential worker, Latin. This poor kid, you know, I'm not an old lady, but like, I feel like they're my babies. You know what I mean? These people. He was so lovely. You could feel his whole personality. He literally just couldn't breathe. So we did trach him eventually. He was tubed for, I think, 3.5 months, meaning he had an ET tube down before we trached him. And I just heard about a month ago, they decannulated him in a different part of the hospital.
That's a win.
That's a win for him. I don't know how he'll be able to move, though. You know, he's a young person. He has that going for him. We expected this guy to die. We coded him a couple of different times. He was on everything that you could possibly imagine. He's like the miracle case.
Bailey Saw, ICU and research nurse, Baltimore, Maryland, travel nurse for COVID-19, New York City.
I am still in New York on COVID ICU assignments. I've been here for about a year total. My 1 year mark is actually April 9th, so almost there. All in all, I've been at 3 different hospitals in New York. I've been at 2 in Queens and 1 in Brooklyn. I think a lot of people thought that COVID went away because the numbers were low. However, that wasn't the case. I would say probably somewhere between 25 to 50% of our ICU, even at the low points in the summer, was still COVID. This one day I was working on a step-down floor and I saw my first husband and wife admitted together. They were both in the room together in a double bedroom. Any movement they made, they would become extremely labored and just out of breath. I went to check on them a few days later and found that they had gotten better, and thankfully they were both discharged to home. Something that I've noticed about the second wave as well is that I'm taking care of a lot younger patients. I remember just standing in the back of the room and crying the entire time and trying to look out the window, hoping no one saw me crying. And this last 8 weeks has been probably the hardest. And I think that's mostly just because so much time has gone by. We're still seeing these patients, and the toll it's taking on healthcare workers just continues to increase.
Bailey, it's great to meet you. Could you tell us a little bit about yourself, your experience? Then I want to dig into your last year in New York.
Sure. I am from Baltimore, Maryland. I've been a nurse for 7 years as of today. I worked primarily at a large teaching hospital in Baltimore where I did ICU and a med-surg tele floor for about 5 years. In 2018, I took a travel nursing job. I came to New York April 9th, and I've been here ever since. For travel nursing, you typically do 13-week contracts, and so I would get to a near end point in that 13-week contract, and I would feel that things were maybe dying down, I'd say I was going home. And then as soon as I would get ready to actually leave, either a large amount of nurses would leave, there'd be an uptick in numbers. And so I've just felt obligated to continue to stay.
And it sounds like that sense of obligation is particularly strong in you. I'm sure other nurses felt, okay, it's time for a break or I need to go home. But you haven't been one of those nurses and you have persisted. How are you able to do that?
I honestly ask myself the same question every day. It's definitely been a struggle. Probably up until this last November, I felt like mentally I was doing okay with it. However, when the cases started to spike again around Thanksgiving time, it really hit me hard. And it's been an ongoing struggle with my mental health since that point.
We read about the traumatic toll on doctors and nurses, but that isn't really reported as much as many other aspects of the story. It's, you know, it's the occasional feature. It seems such a massive problem that's going to be worked out over the course of, you know, months to years to come. And my sense is that you are particularly feeling it, as I'm sure many of your coworkers, but it's clear that this takes a toll on you.
It does. And so I find myself in this position where I'm kind of the go-to for all the travelers.
Assuming that your experience isn't unique in that nurses and other workers are feeling similarly in terms of the continued onslaught of patients, how do you deal with that? Do you discuss it? Are there support groups? Is it an unspoken understanding?
As for dealing with the stress of all this, there is a support group that the hospital I'm at right now has. I've never actually utilized it myself because I just have mixed emotions about what those groups can really offer me to begin with, as well as I don't necessarily want to involve my mental health and emotions in an official way with work. A lot of the coworkers are extremely understanding. And then as in any workplace, you find the people that you're close to and you bond with those people and you share your experiences. I took care of an Indian patient who was young and obese and he passed from COVID. And then the next day I got another Indian young obese patient who also passed from COVID. And that was really the moment that I lost it because I had to go through his bags and pick out his belongings and decide what was important enough to be put away in case his family should ever come to retrieve it. And so since that moment, I've found myself frequently crying at work in the back rooms or in the nutrition closet. At one point, I reached out to a mental health professional to seek counseling, and he basically just told me that I needed to leave nursing and not do this to myself. And so that was kind of the end of me seeking help.
As you said, people are so tired. People are leaving the profession and, you know, the kind of brain drain that we're getting at both at the physician, at the nurse level, at mid-level, at, you know, et cetera, or people that are deciding not to go into the field. Mm-hmm. I think among all the things that are going to have repercussions in the future, that's a pretty big one. But I'm sure you've seen your own colleagues say, that's it for me.
Oh, yeah. I feel like I'm somebody who's, I don't enjoy, you know, punishment by any means, but I've always felt like the need to help people. I kind of came up from humble beginnings and had difficult family circumstances from as young as the age of 7, to be honest with you. So I've been a fairly successful human. I had a whole different career before I was a nurse. I worked overseas for a variety of different governments. I traveled all over the world and paid for my own education. I've always sort of kind of come up. The way in which you sort of, you move forward is you use your colleague. You find a colleague who you can communicate with. I'm a nurse practitioner, adult geriatric. I'm a critical care nurse. For me, in my boat, until at least maybe a year and a half, 2 years from now. I don't predict until next summer, like August 2022, where it would potentially be better if these folks actually get a vaccine.
Was there some truth to the comment that the job, particularly the job at this time and in this situation, takes a toll that is hard to treat otherwise?
There is truth to that comment. If we were to just say, I can't do it anymore and leave, it's who's going to do it. And I hope that eventually this will end, it will slow down. And at that point, we can focus on ourselves and give ourselves time to heal.
Next up is a new segment. where we talk to and hear stories from leading scientists, engineers, or medical researchers doing incredible work way out on the cutting edge. This is a segment we call Citizen Science.
This month, we're going to kick off a segment called Citizen Science, where we meet some of the most creative researchers, engineers, and tinkerers across the planet. You don't need an MD or PhD after your name to make a significant contribution to science. However, our first guest has both degrees and more. His name is Adam Ghazali. Adam is a certified rock star in the field of neuroscience. I met him when I was on faculty at UCSF, where Adam is the David Dolby Distinguished Professor of Neurology, Physiology, and Psychiatry. He runs a research center called Neuroscape, and I urge you to check them out at neuroscape.ucsf.edu. The center conducts studies in attention, memory, perception, non-invasive brain stimulation, and neurofeedback. His group received the first FDA approval for a video game for attention deficit disorder, and they just inaugurated a new initiative for the study of psychedelics for therapeutic purposes. We're going to get into all these areas over the next few episodes, but we're going to start by hearing how Adam became a scientist. Origin stories don't only belong to superheroes. So, Adam, you know, we're both New Yorkers by birth, and I wonder if we can spool the clock back and talk a little bit about your childhood in New York, your time at Bronx High School of Science, and how you began your intellectual journey.
Sure. It's always fun to look back in the past and sort of see the threads and the inspirations that made you who you are today. When I think back, I really go back to the age of like 7 or 8, which is the first time that I expressed to my parents that I wanted to be a scientist, which is fascinating considering I never met a scientist. But growing up, I didn't know a doctor or a scientist. And I was reflecting on how I got interested in science just the other day, even talking to my parents. And I guess from a very early age, I loved tinkering with things. And I have a very faint recollection of playing with a water gun and shooting everyone at one of my parents' parties. And I was a little bit of a wild child. And I remember asking my dad about it and how it worked. And he said, "I don't know, but scientists now." I think that was his way of saying science is cool. Because although he didn't go to college, he had a great respect. And both my parents did for academics. I always, you know, sometimes it feels unfair to say that I was the first person in my family to go to college because I didn't grow up in a non-academic environment. There was always that expectation that we were on that path. That was the first time that I remember hearing about a scientist was over that water gun discussion. And I was like, I want to be a scientist. And I never stopped saying that. I said, maybe I was just stubborn at the time because clearly I didn't fully know what that meant. But it did drive me to do a couple of activities that led to this cascade of events that probably makes me who I am today. And that was really first the reading of science fiction, which was something that I was just voracious about. Isaac Asimov was my first love in the Foundation series, and Arthur C. Clarke and Heinlein and, you know, a lot of the masters, but everything I could find. And then I guess the transition to actual science and not science fiction was through Carl Sagan's Cosmos series. And I know many other scientists of my age grew up with Cosmos, and Carl Sagan had this unique ability, as everyone knows, of really conveying science in a way that was not just accessible, but also exciting and real. And maybe the last bit of inspiration, if I really push and think about all the things that excited me as a kid, was going with my parents to the Museum of Natural History in New York and seeing the giant whale and the dinosaurs and just spending hours walking through those glorious halls and looking at all of the artifacts of our past, both biological and non-biological. And that was really I'd say the three ingredients that set me on my way.
You mentioned that generally because of Carl Sagan and perhaps just the wonder and just scope of it all. We're often drawn to astronomy, to questions of the universe, and the fact that you then, you know, if not pivoted, but just began to focus your efforts onto an equally complex structure, but, you know, one within rather than one without. It's almost like that alchemical saying of as above, so below. You know, mm-hmm. All the complexity and all the richness is there. But it probably was informed by the fact that you were kind of taken by these big questions of science from when you were a little kid.
Yeah, I mean, it's really, I still feel that same emotional response when I think about galaxies and the universe as when I think about the brain. They're very similar to me in terms of how I respond to them, both intellectually and emotionally. I mean, they're vastly, infinitely complex. And I mean, infinite is the right word. It feels that it's impossible for us to know them in their full complexity. We can aspire to that, but we'll probably not succeed. And that's okay. It's that feeling of being an explorer. That's how both brain and outer space feel to me. Mm-hmm. You know, the neuroscience focus was so much more grounded in humanity, in things that affected people's lives directly. Mm-hmm. I mean, that hopefully will not always be true for the cosmos, but for the most part, it is. And that was really what flipped it around the telescope to the microscope from the outside to the inside, was the desire to help people and really make a difference in their lives, to me, felt much more capable of being accomplished by biological sciences.
Mm-hmm. Right. You know, I think when we look at the tools of those different disciplines, a lot of it is like indirect measurements. I'm always fascinated in reading these articles about, you know, a deep mine in Russia that they're reconfiguring to detect neutrinos. And it's like, that is an amazing concept. But, you know, it's pretty indirect, pretty abstract. It's hard to wrap your head around it. You have to have the right mind.
Yeah. And, you know, once you dive into the brain as an area of focus, especially a lifelong focus, it has so many friends on the periphery, right? Philosophy. So what is consciousness? What is the mind? And who am I? You know, life and death, and, you know, all of these really heady but very real aspects of our lives are connected to the brain. You know, figuring out the brain is sort of the gateway to at least one gateway, right? Religion, there's so many paths into trying to address those questions. But I love the path through the brain and neuroscience and using that as a foundation to explore things like the mind and higher order thought and consciousness. And it's gradually over my now 30 years in neuroscience, I've moved closer and closer to a lot of those questions to be able to ask empirically.
And the fact is, you don't need to be a neuroscientist, a neurologist, or even a physician of any kind. When you look at those early Ramon Cajal histopathology and the beautiful staining of these different neural structures, it's such art, and people respond to that. A brief historical aside here. What Adam and I are referring to are two pathologists, Ramon Y Cajal and Camillo Golgi, who shared the Nobel Prize in 1906. Golgi developed a method for staining brain cells or neurons while leaving the surrounding cells transparent. Cajal improved upon this technique. This allowed Cajal to chart the microscopic structure of the brain. He's considered the first neuroscientist. And in fact, his drawings that illustrate the arborizations or tree growing of brain cells are still in use today. One could even say that Adam's interest in these arborizations relate to his parallel interest in nature photography. I like that you've taken the time or the ability to be in awe of these things. I think that's a universal feeling.
Yeah. Speaking of Cajal, I actually used the Golgi stain, which was the stain he used. It's a very challenging stain to use. It only stains some of the neurons, essentially randomly. But I was doing it to count spines, which are these little projections off of dendrites that where the synapses. And they're interesting in themselves. Again, they look like little buds on branches. And they're very hard to stain to look at their structure. And so I was getting images that were very similar to some of those classic Cajal images of the first neurons that he was drawing from looking at that same stain. And every stain shows you a different view of the brain. Same slice, same brain, but different ways of looking at it, which has been a theme throughout my career as I move on in the future and use functional brain imaging and MRI and fMRI. It's fascinating on how many different windows you can take to look at the same thing and get a completely different perspective on it.
So when you were doing your PhD fellowship as part of your education, were you thinking that perhaps you would go into basic science as opposed to clinical training and residency? Was there a cusp there, or did you always feel that you were going to bring it together?
At that point, I wanted to do both. I went on to residency. I went to Penn for my residency in neurology. Many of my friends that were MD PhDs picked a road at some point. Some left science completely and went and did their clinical training, and many others left the clinical side, and some did not even finish med school. It's such a long road. Some people just, you know, sort of peel off on one of those routes along the way. And so those were the interactions, the clinical interactions that I had that convinced me that in my next phase, as I went to California and began my postdoctoral training, that I was going to leave the microscope and enter the world of cognitive neuroscience, where I would sort of take a step up. So like a higher resolution view, a higher view of the brain, but lower resolution. So you can see more brain at the same time, but you can't really see those neurons anymore or those dendrites. But you can ask questions that were more appealing to me because they were closer to the human condition. Questions of attention and memory and perception, those were the things that were driving me to leave the very under the microscope view of the brain and move to functional brain imaging in humans. And I was always trying to relate my discovery process and science of organization in the world, which is sort of what science is trying to do, and the discovery in art and nature photography, which was looking not just for organization, but beauty. To me, they really felt almost the same way. Like going out in a forest with my camera was not so different than being in a lab in a microscope, looking through a microscope or looking at an image from an MRI. So they feel very connected to me. And that was the time that I really got to dive deep into photography. My photography business started because I was working at the hospital, and late at night, I would bring in prints that I printed on my own Epson printer and show the nursing staff. You get really close with the nursing staff because you're up all night together. And I'd show them my photographs and they're like, these are beautiful. I would like to buy one. I was like, really? And then I realized that the hospital itself was devoid of beauty and nature. And people were suffering, not just in waiting rooms, but in ICUs and surgical suites. So I started selling my fine art prints to hospitals. And that was my business model at the time. And it was actually quite successful because there was an incredible need for beauty in hospitals. So they're out there.
But I love the impulse of looking around at those lime green walls in a hospital and going, you know, this needs something. Let me help beautify it. You had talked about your clinical focus initially on geriatrics and, as you said, elements of dementia, et cetera. Do you think that the fact that certainly at that time and even now, there are just a scarcity of medical therapeutics, I'm not even sure we had Aricept as a tool at that time, was the lack of effective therapeutics part of your impetus to begin to look at digital therapeutics or other methods of treatment that were just not in existence or not available?
Undoubtedly. I mean, neurology is endlessly fascinating from an intellectual point of view, but it's incredibly frustrating in a practical way, as everyone knows, especially a neurosurgeon.
And
it's the reality because there's not a lot you can do for most conditions. So that was definitely the frustration of not having those tools to make a meaningful difference in many people's lives was the impetus for me to become innovative and find new approaches.
I said, in all honesty, I'll do everything I can, but I may not be able to save him. And the mother looked at me and started to cry, and she said, "I know that." She says, "But I know you'll give it your best shot, and you'll treat him like he's your son." She says, "And that's all I can ask for." And I looked at her, and I put my hand on her shoulders, and I said, "Absolutely." I said, "He is my son, and I'll do what I can, and I'll let you know how it goes." I also asked if there are any symptoms related to COVID-19, and she denied anything that sounded meaningful. So again, went back into the operating room, dreading the possibility of putting on all the protective gear and all the challenges that it carried. And fortunately, when I got back there, the call from the lab said that he was COVID-19 negative. So now we just had the problem of stemming what appeared to be uncontrolled bleeding coming out from the backside of his head. And then when we took off his dressings and all the bandages around his head, there appeared to be liters of blood pouring out of his head onto the floor. And it certainly looked as if the blood was not congealing at all, that he was perhaps in what we call DIC, where the patients just start to bleed everywhere. But we're there, ready to go. Massive transfusion protocol was going on. And we started to try to at least get some control. And as we started to work with the incision, just to be able to see what we're dealing with, blood and brain products continued to shoot across the room, obviously under tremendous pressure and hemorrhaging, more blood than we could actually put into his veins. And so after a period of time, it was very clear we were not going to be able to get direct control with, at that time, was most likely the sinus. We did our best to pack it off and then just close the skin to at least stem the bleeding itself. And although we were eventually able to close the skin with great effort and we didn't have copious liters of blood flowing onto the floor, it was pretty obvious that that in itself may stop his actual hemorrhaging, but unfortunately would be transmitted to the brain itself. And by the time we left the operating room shortly after this, one could appreciate that his pupils were no longer working, and nor was there anything else that was functioning as consistent with a picture of brain death. And I sat and reflected and thought, how could such a young man, potentially so full of promise, have survived the first time to come back a second time to the place where it all began? And I thought to myself, he probably never had a chance. This is his routine, and despite being fortunate beyond all belief and having won the lottery the first time after he was shot, he was unable to capitalize on that and still was hanging out with the wrong people at the wrong time. And at this point, I was unable to give him an additional lease on life. And I went out to tell Mom and his sisters and aunts that he was no longer hemorrhaging from the head, but unfortunately the pressure in the brain was increasing every minute and it was unlikely we'd be able to save him. And I felt miserable and terrible because despite every best intention and all the right efforts and all the right neurosurgical things that we know how to do, it was a far cry from what he really needed, and we were unable to save him. It took 48 hours before the patient finally died, but it was a long 48 hours, and there were lots of discussions on how and why and what to do and so forth. But I couldn't help but think how such a lucky kid the first time was so unlucky the second time.
We at The Life Medical are students of history, and it's that history that may allow us to bring our two stories together. When you look at the earliest recordings of neurosurgery, the treatment of penetrating head injuries, spears in those days, gunshot wounds today, the general teaching was to leave it alone. The outcome was so appalling that surgery or any ability to intervene seemed hopeless. This began to change in the mid-19th century, and it started with the Crimean War. Yes, the very war we referred to earlier that served as the battlefield and the birthing of modern nursing with Florence Nightingale and her team. It was at this time, over 160 years ago, that the era of modern anesthesia began and some of the understanding of basic antisepsis. So the methods of treating a gunshot wound, cleaning the wound, debriding or removing contaminated areas, controlling the bleeding, closing the scalp, began in that time. And many of these methods we continue to use today. Our technology has vastly improved. We're much more sophisticated in terms of medical practices. But the human stories remain remarkably the same. And we will bring more of these stories to you next episode. I'm your host, Dr. Peter Zahos, and thank you so much for joining us on The Life Medical.
The Life Medical is written, executive produced, and hosted by Dr. Peter Zahos. The series is produced, edited, and mixed by DDR Stewart.